Parshas Vayigash on Chanukah, seventh day of Chanukah. So I wanted to do today a little break from what we normally do. We're going to have two distinct topics, two distinct discussions that we'll have. The first one is so relevant to Chanukah that I just could not pass up the opportunity while we are going through Chanukah to mention a Ramban, a comment that Nachmanides makes on the Parsha. So we'll discuss that as one unit, and then we'll just sort of introduce a new topic. But this is so Chanukah related. So this is the first comment is on page 258 and 259. This is later on into the Parsha. We're going to go back to the beginning of the story. The beginning of the Parsha, of course, has the confrontation between Yehuda and Yosef. Yosef, who has planted his goblet, his cup in Binyamin's sack, and has now brought all the brothers back to Mitzrayim, and he's threatening not to allow Binyamin to return home. And the beginning of the parasha is the confrontation in which Yosef eventually reveals himself, and we'll speak about that more a little later. What I wanted to just mention in the beginning here is, as the story, of course, develops, Yosef reveals himself, he sends word back to his father that all is okay, and he invites Yaakov and the rest of the family to come down to Mitzrayim, to come down to live with him in Egypt. And then the Torah describes at the end of the Parsha how the entire family of Yaakov, the entire Beis Yisrael, or Bnei Yisrael, did in fact then travel down to Egypt, where they would then begin dwelling. And what the Torah does is the Torah lists the names of those who traveled down, a grand total of 70 individuals. The number 70 comes up a lot. And Torah, there's certain numbers which just come up often. 70 nations of the world, and we have 70 languages, and we have 70 souls of the Jewish people who travel down to Egypt in the beginning. 210 years later, that 70 turns into about 3,600,000 men just between the ages of 20 and 60. Figure out the numbers, it's close to 3 million. Quite a miraculous explosion of population from the 70 that went down to the 3 million which left. But in any case, the Torah lists the names of those who came down. So it begins, what's relevant to us for the beginning of this comment, if you look at verse 7, we could just go back to 5 just to get the whole idea. We're just reading it in English for this part. Yaakov arises from Beersheba. The sons of Israel transported Yaakov, their father, as well as their young children and wives, in the wagons which Paro had sent. And they go down, they take their livestock, they take their wealth, all of his offspring. And then the Torah in verse 8 begins actually listing who came down. These are the names of the children of Israel who were coming down to Egypt. You have Yaakov and his children, his firstborn Reuven, and Reuven's sons, Chanoch, Palu, Chetron, and Carmi, and Shimon's son, and we list them all, and Levi's sons in verse 11. Verse 12 gives us Yehuda's sons. Verse 13 gives us Yisachar's sons. Verse 14 gives us Zebulun's sons. Verse 15. These are all the sons of Leah. You're wondering, why am I going through this? We'll get there. These are all the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Yaakov in Padan Aram, in addition to Dinah, his daughter. So we list by mother. That's how the Torah describes the list of our 70 children. We go through Leah's sons. Leah had 6 sons and 1 daughter. And then we conclude at the end of verse 15, all the people, his sons and daughters, numbered 33. Now, I didn't go slow enough for you to be bothered by the following question, but had I read these names a little bit slower, you would have very quickly, mathematically calculated that there are actually only 32 names listed here. Now, we know that the Torah is a science for its great depth, certainly capable of counting names correctly. So the sages were bothered by the fact that after giving us a list of all of the children and grandchildren born to Yaakov through Leah, his wife, and then the Torah specifically lists them as 33, part of a larger number of count, which is going to give us a grand total of 70, there are only 32 people actually listed in this count. Rashi says, what's the meaning of this? Says Rashi, uviparto aniyata moitze el alamed beis. If you count them, you only find 32. Elazu yocheved. Who is the missing person? Yocheved. Who is Yocheved? Yocheved is the mother of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yocheved is the wife of Amram. Yocheved and Amram together give birth to Aharon, and then Aharon's younger brother Moshe, who's eventually going to lead the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim 210 years from now. who is the missing person, Yocheved, and why is she not listed here in this count? Say the sages, Shenolda Bein Hachoymos B'chnisason Le'ir. She was born literally in between the walls as they were entering into the city of, or the country of Mitzrayim, as they're going in. That's when she was born. Quotes a verse that she was born to Levi. The way the verse describes it in the book of Numbers in Bamidbar, when it goes through the list, very often the Torah lists certain genealogies, when it lists the birth of Yocheved, it says she was born to Levi in Mitzrayim. She was born in Mitzrayim, the sages deduce, but she wasn't conceived in Mitzrayim. She was conceived back in the land of Canaan, and as timing worked its way out, she was being brought down while her mother was still pregnant there, and she was born on the way in, and that's how the sages understand that's where the 33rd person is, born to Levi, the daughter, but she was conceived back in Canaan. That's why she's sort of hinted at saying 32 names, 33 in the count, and that's referring to Yocheved. The significance of that, I'm not discussing today, the significance that she was conceived in Canaan and she was born on the way in, not for today's discussion. What I do want to point out is a comment that the Ibn Ezer, one of the classical commentators, is very bothered by the statement of the sages. And he's bothered for the following reason. As I've already alluded to, how many years go by between the Jewish people's descent down to Egypt and their ascent out of Egypt? 210. Who knows how old Moshe was when the Jews left Mitzrayim?
80.
He was 80, correct. Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old when the Jews left Mitzrayim. So, again, taking out your mathematical caps, if Yocheved, according to the sages, was born on the way down to Mitzrayim, 210 years before the Jews leave, and her son, Moshe, is 80 years old when they leave, how old was she when she gave birth to Moshe?
130,
correct. So you say, well, it's a big deal. Okay, she was 130. Well, it only was a generation before this. And it is a big deal, right? 130. She's 130. Now, you'll say, in the very beginning of the Torah, in the times of Noah, and in the times of Adam and Eve, they were having children, 500, 600, 700, that was normal. Something clearly changed after the generation of the flood. There was like a new world order, because when Sarah and Abraham are on the scene, and this is only the grandparents of Yaakov, we make a very big deal about the fact that Sarah had a child at the age of 90, and that Avram was already 100. That was way out of the norm of expected parental behavior, that they should be bearing children at that age. So the Ibn Ezra comments, he says, I don't understand what the sages are talking about. True, there's a textual problem here. The text lists 32 names, gives us a number of, a head count of 33, and the sages say, oh, that's a reference to Yocheved, she was born on the way in, and that's why she's only hinted at. So it can't be. The Torah makes a big deal about miracles. When the Torah lists the miracle of Sarah, when she gave birth at the age of 90, we have like verse upon verse upon verse describing that an angel came and said she was going to have a child. It was like a big deal. How could this just sneak under the radar? 130? That's not a bigger miracle than Sarah, who had a child at only 90? How come it's not mentioned? How come it's just slipped under? And so he's very bothered by the fact that such a large miracle should not be mentioned. That's his question. What I want to share with you, and this is why it is so relevant to Hanukkah that I could not pass up this opportunity, is the response of the Ramban. Nachmanides' response to this problem with such a fundamental precept in Judaism as it relates again to this Yontif that we're in. Says the Ramban, Nachmanides answers as follows. Al Kolpanim, he writes, certainly the birth of Yocheved was a tremendous miracle. From the miracles, the Nisim Hanistarim, the category of miracles which we would classify as hidden miracles, Shehem Yisod HaTorah. And this concept, this principle of a miracle, is the foundation of all of Torah. This idea of a hidden miracle, which he'll define in a minute, is the fundamental rock upon which we stand. Says the Ramban. Let's get to the exact point that I want to read. Omer loch davishu emesu bar. I'll tell you a true precept, he says. Ki anisim hanasim al yidei novi shi yisnave kein mitchila. The Ramban distinguishes between two types of miracles listed in the Torah, or two types of miracles. One you have in which is proclaimed by a prophet or by an angel in some level. Somebody records this and this will take place. Some type of miraculous event like that. When something is preceded, is predicted by someone or something, that's always listed in the Torah. But, says the Ramban, Vahanasime Alehem, miracles which just take place without fanfare, without anyone announcing that it will take place, La Azor Tzadik, either it takes place to help out a certain righteous individual, something takes place to make his life a little bit easier, O La Hachris Rasha, or to cut down the wicked, Lo Yas Kiru Batera Obanavim. You don't find that mentioned anywhere in the Torah. If Hashem makes some sort of miracle and there's a tzaddik passing along and it was cloudy that day so it wouldn't be too hot, those miracles aren't listed. Let's say it was a real type of miracle, just not just that it was cloudy, but something bizarre happened and he traveled the course of a week's time in a day. It's not going to be mentioned either. Not necessary to mention the change in nature, the miraculous events that are done for the benefit of a righteous person or to cut down a wicked person. Only things which were predicted in advance, which somehow then are a landmark for us. Look, this person says this and this will happen, and it happened. Those are the things that are mentioned. Why, says the Ramban, are the everyday occurrences which are done for the benefit of the righteous not mentioned? Because everything in the Torah is a hidden miracle. The Am HaTorah, the nation of the Torah, us the Jewish people, Ein b'chol inyano, in every single thing that we have and that we are, Raknis, all that we have are miraculous events, Lo Teva u'minhag, we never have anything of nature, natural events, or just, that's the way that things go. Brings a couple of proof, and I want to expound upon this. Says the Ramban, what is his greatest proof that everything that we stand upon is an event like that? Shehare Yehudei HaTorah Kulam Ososu Moftim. This we've discussed, I believe, other times, because it's such a fundamental principle. The Yehudei HaTorah, the rewards for keeping the Torah and the mitzvot, says the Ramban, all of them are miraculous. They're wondrous events. What's his proof? What does the Torah say if a person doesn't keep Shemitah? If a person doesn't keep the laws of the seventh year in Israel, you're not allowed to work the land. You have to leave your land fallow. 6 years you work it. Seventh year known as a Shemitah year. This is a Shemitah year currently in Eretz Yisrael. Farmers are not permitted to work the land. What's the reward and the punishment? So if you keep it, you'll be blessed. And if you don't, you'll be kicked out of the land of Israel. Or you won't have rain. Or your crops won't grow. Things like that. So, or punishments that there are certain forbidden foods which are not allowed to be eaten. And if a person eats that, so there's certainly certain divine punishments which come down. So the Ramban says, that's the natural order of the world? I work my field and it stops raining? I don't get it. What is my plowing my field have to do with whether or not the rains fall? What do the Jewish people putting tefillin on have to do with whether or not there's peace in the land of Israel? These things have no connection to anything. And the Torah says regularly, you want to know what to do to have peace in the land of Israel? You want to know what to do to have good crops and to have rain and to have blessings with children and blessings with all your partners? Do this. That has nothing to do with anything. Why? How do I put on tefillin and I get rain? The Torah says so explicitly. It says, everything about the Torah is all about miraculous events. But they're the type of miraculous events which occur in the natural order. It rained today. Are you going to be able to prove to me that it rained because I put on tefillin? I can't prove that. It's a natural event. But everything in the Torah is rooted in a response which goes above and beyond what we would call nature. Rabbi Tatz, who was here last week, so just to continue on our weekend with him, so he says in one of his tapes the following example, the difference between his open miracles and hidden miracles. So he says, the difference, he says, an example, let's say a person is standing over a cliff overlooking a beautiful scenery and loses his footing and starts falling down over the edge of the cliff. And as he's on his way down, being very close to becoming a permanent part of the scenery, he grabs onto a branch that's sticking out from the side of the cliff. And so he's holding on the branch, he's dangling 1,000 feet over the rocks, wondering what in the world is going to happen to him. And as he's sitting there, the root begins to pull itself out. His weight's too heavy. Just before it entirely dislodges, and he starts pummeling down to the earth, somebody on the top of the cliff, not knowing that he's down there, starts practicing his rope climbing, And he throws a rope down because he wants to learn how to... And it happens to catch onto your arm. And he says, what's that? It pulls up, and lo and behold, you're there. So how would you view such a miracle? Say, a miracle or not a miracle? Like, that's ridiculous, right? That's a miracle. But it's a miracle which worked within the natural order of events. There was nothing outside of the realm of natural things which happened. It's just, you said, that's absolutely crazy that while I'm there and I'm holding it on the phone, somebody just came and was practicing lassoing and he happened to get my arm. So you say, it's absurd. It's a miracle, but it's a miracle which fits within the natural order of events. If, as the branch was about to dislodge, you suddenly started levitating to the top of the cliff and just floated up there and said, whoa! Now, that would be the type of miracle which, right, is a break from the natural order. That's the type of miracle that, whoa, look at that. Those types of miracles, says around the first type, everything in the world is like that. Jew believes in the concept of a God who is running the world and controlling events. That's an extreme example in which anybody who would see that would, you have to be entirely blind to say, wow, what a coincidence. That's just amazing. That's crazy. But all of the events in our lives are like that on various spectrum of how much of the natural world is being manipulated to orchestrate certain events. But it's all in the realm of miraculous, says Ramban. There's nothing less miraculous about that than anything which takes place in the world than the fact that there's rain. The rain is a natural thing. Oh, but you should just know it's entirely contingent upon keeping Shabbos, keeping the mitzvahs, putting on. So what does that have to do with anything? Well, that will somehow affect whether or not it rains or not. You say, that's a natural event which is taking place, which is rooted in the miraculous. So the Ramban says, those types of miracles aren't listed. The Torah doesn't list every single time Hashem manipulates the natural world in order to have... Everything about the natural world is being manipulated by Hashem for one purpose or another. We don't always see the big picture why that is, but what's the difference between that and that? So those aren't listed. So says Ramban, so Yocheved was 130 when she had a child. Yeah, and that's less miraculous than a 25-year-old woman having a baby. What's the difference? This one is more in the natural order of things that we're used to, and that one is less in the natural order of things that we're used to. That's because of the spectrum that we've gotten accustomed to and the general natural order that Hashem runs the world in. Those aren't listed. There's no need to list those because they're all miracles. So some are less miraculous than others, but the specific... If a prophet or an angel in the case of Sarah comes and says, you are going to experience a miraculous event, those are the kinds of things which are listed and specifically documented. But the things which take place, so Ramban says, I'm not bothered at all by the fact that Yocheved might have been 130 at the time that she gave birth to Moshe. In fact, she was 127 when she gave birth to Aaron. Neither one of those raised my eyebrows, says the Ramban, and therefore there's no need to list that. This is a classic Chanukah idea. This is really at the roots of what it is that we're doing. As you know, there are many, many famous questions about Hanukkah. The most famous question about Hanukkah, the most famous, is the fact that we celebrate Hanukkah for 8 days and not 7. Because they found a flask of oil. And this question, I hope you, on some way or another, hopefully you've heard this question at some point over the years. There are over 100 answers suggested. There's a book that was printed. 100 answers for the following question. They found a flask of oil. How long was it supposed to burn for?
One
night. What did it burn for? 8 nights. How long was the miracle? 7 nights. How long should we celebrate Hanukkah for? 7. We're celebrating for 8 for it. The miracle wasn't 8 nights. The miracle was only 7 nights or 7 days. First was natural. They had a flask of oil. So we don't need to celebrate that. The commemoration of the miraculous event of the candle is only 7. Famous, again, there are hundreds of answers. One book itself lists and compiles 100 different answers for this particular question. So, just for example, one of the answers that's given is it was miraculous that they found oil. Just the fact that they found a flask of oil that was still pure and not yet defiled, that in itself is miraculous, so we celebrate one day even for that first oil. But one of the answers, one of the classic answers that's given, is this exact idea that the Ramban is describing. A flask of oil, so how long should it burn for? So it should burn for one day. How long did it burn for? 8. So we say, in our perception of the world, it was miraculous for 7, and natural for 1. But the reality of the world is, he who says oil should burn for one day says oil can burn for 8 days. There's no difference in the fact that it burned for the first and for the eight. In fact, the Talmud has an explicit story describing this idea that one of the sage's daughters came complaining to him on an Erev Shabbos, right before Shabbos, that she had no money to buy oil to light her Shabbos candles. She was so poor, so destitute, she had nothing, all she had was some vinegar. So he said, so light the vinegar. So he says, she says, Abba, vinegar doesn't burn, I need oil. So he says, what's the problem? The one who said oil should burn will tell you, it will allow the vinegar to burn. And so she lit the vinegar and it burned. Miraculous? Well, if you live with a worldview that says, you know, what difference does it make? Hashem could do big, Hashem could do small, he created it all in the same way. So one of the classic answers for that question is, yeah, we light all 8 nights. Because we really recognize Hanukkah time. The first day is just as miraculous as the eighth day. The real way to say that is, the first day is just as natural as the other seven. What do you mean miracles? Miracles is a word, is a concept which goes beyond our perception of what should have happened. But a true perspective is, whatever the Ribbono Shel'Olam wants, whatever Hashem wants to run the world is just as well. Just as the Ramban says, we don't list every miracle which takes place because everything in the Torah is miraculous. Everything is outside the order of what we would have expected. The whole concept, everything that we stand for is above and beyond. The consequences of everything that we do, which affects the natural order, which has no relevance to the actions that we're actually doing, are all miraculous. And so the lighting of the first night and the lighting of the eighth night are really all lumped together in recognition of that concept. Which the Ramban so eloquently expresses based on this hint that the sages say of the birth of Yocheved and the lack of need or fanfare for, with her miraculous birth of her children at the ages of 127 and 130, like, big deal. No need to make anything about that. That is a very Hanukkah idea. I couldn't help myself as we sit here on the seventh night of Hanukkah, seventh day, celebrating. Okay, that's one. Phase two. So if you totally zoned out for that first half, you could zone back in. We're going to start a whole new topic. All right, let's go back to the beginning of the parasha. Let's go back to this famous confrontation between Yosef and between his brothers and this revelation. So let's learn from the beginning of chapter 45. It's on page 252 and 253. Alright, so the parasha began just the page before this, just to get your bearings. If you flip back one page, you'll see the beginning of the parasha. Yehuda steps forward and says to Yosef that he has personally accepted responsibility for Binyamin's safe return back to his father Yaakov in the land of Canaan, and he will not stand for or allow this to go where he's going to be held back. He will take his place in captivity in the land of Mitzrayim, but Binyamin must be sent back to Yaakov in Mitzrayim. And he gives him a whole long speech, the whole first page there, you can read through it, you'll see it on Shabbos, God willing. He goes through the whole story, I told my father I would do this, and I put my life on the line, and I risk my this world and my next world, that this should happen. If I can't go back, my father's going to go into his grave with grief. So so what I want to start with, so chapter 45, Perek Mem Hei. Again, I want to point out, which I point out almost regularly because it's relevant almost every week. You'll notice that on the English side, there is a break and a new chapter in verse chapter 45 there. On the Hebrew side, there is no paragraph break. I remember I mentioned many times that it was not the Jewish printers who put in the different chapter headings. We have the different aliyahs, the different seven aliyahs every Shabbos, which the sages enacted. And then the Torah itself has different paragraph breaks, telling you where to stop and take a pause. And then there are times where the Torah does not put in a break, which is just connecting it as it's one long story. It's one long thought, and it needs to be taken as a whole. So even though I'm starting in the beginning of Perek Mem Hei, but that's just an arbitrary starting point. We're really smack in the middle of the story, and there is no break on the Hebrew side. The Torah doesn't put in a little paragraph break, which you see. This whole parasha, I believe, is one of those parashas that doesn't have one. I believe, if I remember correctly, oh, there is one, I'm sorry. If you look on page 258, you have one. Yeah, it's not till much later. You have your first pause in the story. This is the climax of the story. But in any case, that being said, So the verse starts, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1, V'lo yochol Yosef lehis apek l'chol hanitzavim olav. Yosef was not able to restrain himself in the presence of all who stood before him. Vayikra, so he calls out, Hotziu kol ish me'olai, everyone that needs to be removed from before me. V'lo omar ish ito b'his vada Yosef elochis. So no one remained with him when he made himself known to his brothers. So the verse begins, this revelation of Yosef begins with the phrase, V'lo yochol lehisapek. Yosef was not able to restrain himself. So on a simple level, what that means, that he was not able to restrain himself, so the Ramban comments, what it meant was, you can imagine in Yosef's chamber there were many people around. There were lots of people witnessing this event. And here you have the brothers' impassioned plea. Yehuda stepping forward and saying, my father will die if Binyamin doesn't return home. And clearly, now remember, Binyamin was the youngest of the brothers, and Yehuda was number four. So there was quite a number of years between them. Although Binyamin wasn't a little child at the time. He was at least 22. He was probably in his upper 20s at the time. So he wasn't a child. But Yehuda says, I am staying here. You can take me as a prisoner. You can do whatever you want to me. This child is going back to his father. So the Ramban comments, Yosef wasn't able to tolerate it anymore. Everybody in the chamber was on the brother's side, saying, oh, come on. You know, they were moved by Yehuda's plea. They were moved by his willingness to give up of himself to send this child back to his father in Canaan. And they were putting on the pressure on Yosef to give in. So with that, so the verse says, Yosef wasn't able to tolerate it anymore, so he said, I want everybody to clear out so that he'd be able to reveal himself to the brothers. That's on the simple level of the text the Ramban writes. Sages saw a deeper level in the meaning that Yosef wasn't able to tolerate it. What wasn't Yosef able to tolerate in the presence of all who stood before him? Not that they were putting on pressure, but Rashi quotes from the sages, Lo yochol Yosef lehis apek lechol hanitzavim, lo haya yochol lisvol, he could not tolerate, shiyu mitzrim nitzavim alav, that the mitzrim should be there and present, v'shoymen, that they should hear, she'ochiv mitzvayishin v'hodiyu lehem, because his brothers would be embarrassed when he revealed himself. And what Yosef couldn't tolerate wasn't the pressure, the sages say at a deeper level, that everybody was putting on him to cede to Yehuda's request that he switch places with Binyamin. Yosef knew that he was about to reveal himself, that his mission had been fulfilled, all of his tests to make sure that the brothers truly were remorseful about what they had done to him, and that they would stand up for his brother Binyamin. It had all been fulfilled. He was ready to reveal himself, and he couldn't tolerate the idea that all of these Egyptians would be there, and they would see the brother's humiliation and embarrassment when he would reveal himself. So he orders everybody out that nobody should be present when he revealed himself to embarrass his brothers. That's what the sages have to say in that. Continuing on. Vayitenes kolo b'vchi, verse 2, so he raised up his voice with crying and tears. Vayishmu Mitzrayim, vayishma beis paro. The whole of Egypt heard, including Paro's whole household, heard the crying and the tears of Yosef. And what does he say to them? Vayomer Yosef el Echov. Yosef says to his brothers, Ani Yosef ha'od avi chai. Famous words, I am Yosef. I am Yosef. Is my father still alive? What's the brother's reaction to this revelation from Yosef? So the Torah says, V'lo yochlu echov la'anosov. So they could not answer, could not speak. Were entirely rendered speechless. They were disconcerted, Art Scroll translates. They were totally bewildered before him. Rashi comments, out of embarrassment. They were so embarrassed. They were so bewildered after what had just transpired that they had no words to express. Now there's a statement of the sages on this which requires explanation. The sages say as follows on this interaction, in which Yosef reveals himself and he says the simple words, Ani Yosef, I am Yosef, is my father still alive? The Medrash, the sages say as follows, Amar Rav Shimon ben Elazar, Oy lonu miyoyim hadin, woe unto us. What is going to be with us, say the sages, on the day of judgments? On the day when we are finished in this world after 120 years, Oy lanu miyoyim hatoychacha. What will be on the day of rebuke when it is all finished for us here in this world, and we then face the heavenly courts? Say the sages, it's going to be bad. What's the proof that it's going to be bad? Says Rav Shimon ben Elazar. Because Yosef was the Ketanim Shel Shvatim. He was the youngest of the tribes. He was a little boy, a lad, compared to his brothers. V'lo yochlu achiv la'anos oso kiniv halu mipanim. And his brothers couldn't even speak. They were so bewildered, so thrown off, so disconcerted that they couldn't speak. When Hashem will come and will rebuke us according to our actions, al achas kama v'kama. How much more so will we be disconcerted? Will we be bewildered that we will have nothing to say? Sages, that's what the sages say. A frightening little statement about what will be at the end of days. Now, what's of note in this statement is what Reb Shimon ben Elazar opens up his statements, Oy lanu from the day of judgment and from the day of rebuke. Because the brothers could not even tolerate the rebuke of this youngest brother Yosef. They couldn't even handle that, they had nothing to say. So what's going to be when Hashem rebukes us? Now, the problem with this, the Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, who was the great Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, the Mir still stands, I believe the Mir is the largest yeshiva in the world at this point. I think over 2,000 boys. If you've ever been to Yerushalayim, Mea Sharm, it's tucked away in a corner of Mea Sharm. It's not a corner anymore, it's like a whole block. There are like four or five different buildings. It's quite an institution. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was a Rosh Hashiva there 30, 40 years ago. So he writes as well, he says, Yosef never rebuked his brothers. There's no rebuke in his statement. We think of rebuke, we think of a nice Musar Shmuz. Someone stands up and says, and you did this wrong, and you did that wrong, and you're not doing this well, and you need to be doing this better. We've all, at some way or another, at some point in our lives, either been on the receiving end or on the giving end of what we like to call in the yeshiva Musar Shmuz. You know, you're told what needs to be and what shouldn't be and what was. Yosef doesn't do any of that. Yes, he doesn't give his brothers a shmuz. He doesn't yell at them and say, I told you my dreams. I told you that they were just divine. I was just reporting a prophecy that I had. I told you should have never sold me down to Mitzrayim, but he doesn't do any of that. He says two simple words. Ani Yosef. I'm Yosef, I'm your brother. And they can't answer, they can't speak. And from this the sages say, oh, what's going to be with us when at the end of 120 years Hashem gives us rebuke? Where's the rebuke? So Reb Chaim says, just a magnificent and frightening idea all at the same time. He says, rebuke, the word tochacha, has another root in that word. L'hochiach in Hebrew also means to prove. When bring a proof in the Gemara, it's a similar word to tochacha, they're related. Whenever in Hebrew two words are related, it's because they share meanings. It says, true rebuke is not someone yelling and berating you for what you did or didn't do, what you could have done or should have done or will do. True rebuke is a revelation of what you could have been, of what you should have been. When I show you the truth of the situation, the reality of what could have been or should have been, because you're capable of doing it. The truth of the situation, and you suddenly see clearly what is, nothing more needs to be said. Just when I show you that reality, where we live in a world with so many masks, and we don't see clearly the bigger picture of things, when that's shown, there is no greater rebuke than that. Yosef's brothers went through an unbelievable ordeal over the last 22 years. Rabbi Tatz, in his book, Living Inspired, it's worth reading if you have that book at home. I'm sure we have it here in the library also. Goes through this concept of ordeal to salvation tests. And he describes, if you look through the brothers' experience, it started with a mistake. They were sure that Yosef was on the other side. They were sure that Yosef was going to bring them down and ruin the Jewish people. So they had a Beis Din, they got a tribunal together, and they decided Yosef needs to be gotten rid of. It's a mistake. They had their calculations. But from that moment on, their life was one miserable experience. They watched their father suffer for 22 years with the pain of losing somebody like the day that he first found out. Prophecy was removed from their father. Now, it's hard, we could say those words, but imagine what it was like when you had a Yaakov Avinu communicating with Hashem in his divine prophecy with that spirit, and then you see that removed from him. Your father is unable, he doesn't have it anymore. Mourning and pain, and you know it's your fault. You're the cause of that.
But you said last week it all had to play out.
It did. But that's the thing. Put yourselves in the it did. Put yourself in the brother's experience as they go through this.
They could have been any other way. Suppose they hadn't sold them, then we wouldn't have gotten into Egypt.
I'm not 100%. The issue for this idea is go through their experience of it. They see that happening to their father. I'm not saying it could have happened in maybe this way or another way, 100%. But from their experience, they don't know that. They're experiencing their father's pain for 22 years. They're experiencing his loss of prophecy. They go down to Egypt. They're dealt with as spies. They're accused of things which they've never done. Their brother Shimon is taken captive. They're sent back. The money is returned. More confusion. Sent back down again. And this time, again treated harshly, but sent back with food, with their money again returned. And then Binyamin is found to be a thief. They go back down having... It's just an entire mishmash of an experience, and then in two words, everything becomes clear. Ani Yosef suddenly clarified 22 years, even more than that, right? It's not from the reads, like the last 25 years of their life just became crystal clear in two words. Ani Yosef. You can't even get out that. Oh, because you're flooded with understanding. You are flooded with insight. The dreams, the decision to sell him, the person who we thought was the second in command, who we didn't know who he was causing us so much trouble, making us bring Binyamin back and treating us. Not only were you this, do I understand that, you were the reason for the salvation. It was because of all the trials that you put us through, because of all the tests to see if we would have what it took to defend Binyamin, if we would stand up to all of that. All of that was part of getting to this point where we now are, and that sense of clarity, of understanding, of insight, all comes with those words. And when you have that, there is no greater toichacha, there is no greater rebuke than showing you the truth of the situation, and then you yourself then see, oh, that's what could have been. Say the sages, Oy lonu miyoyim hadin, Oy lonu miyoyim hatoichacha. What's going to be with us on the day of judgment, on the day of rebuke, when Hashem reveals Himself to us and says, Ani Hashem. And in that moment where we move from this world to the next, the world of a lack of clarity. We don't see things clear. We all know that. I don't need to say that. We don't have things clear. We don't. It's clouded. We have all sorts of doubts, and we don't understand the big picture, and this event, and that event, and why this is taking... We don't see any of that. And so we swim along trying to do the best that we can with lots of questions and points that we don't understand. And there'll be that moment, of Ani Hashem. I am God. And just like for the brothers hearing the words, Ani Yosef, it was a rebuke, because they had nothing to say. It was, I'm speechless now that I have all that understanding. So too what will happen to each and every one of us. Each and every one of us. The sages have so much to say on this, the significance of Yosef's revelation, as it means to, when you go from a period of trial and ordeal where you don't have that clarity, to a moment of clarity, and how it's possible in two words to change the whole thing. We've all experienced that, by the way, in microcosms of our lives, where all of a sudden you get a piece of information, and all of a sudden the whole other episode, you know, makes sense. Sometimes it's just a conversation that, like, someone, you didn't know that someone had, whatever, you can come up with a whole bunch of examples where you were missing a piece of information, you didn't get something, and therefore you had lots of questions about whatever, you just were confused about something, and like, in one small piece of information, I get it, and then all of a sudden everything makes sense. So that's all little microcosms of our existence in this world. The word olam, by the way, the word for world, comes from the root of he'olam, of hidden. Because Hashem's presence in this world is hidden, and we don't see things clearly as we navigate our way through this ocean of life. And there'll be a time when that will become clear, and when that becomes clear, the world will become clear with knowledge of Hashem, and there'll be that big, oh, moment. And as the sages say, we will be rendered speechless by the clarity that we have. The frightening, encouraging, all at the same time, inspiring, I hope, message that we have from Yosef's revelation to his brothers in trying to achieve as great a clarity as we can now. But that's the sages use this as the example of what it's like to live in a world and go through a world where we don't have that. And then in a moment's time, we suddenly will.
But Rabbi, the next couple of words. Not only six. When he asks about his father, they've already talked about his father. He knows his father's alive. Because it's already come out. So then he adds, is my father alive? It's a question. Why does he say that?
Why does he want to know that?
Because he already knows that.
Well, he doesn't know that. Well, he knows that because, meaning that they've come down the second time and they've already reported that. So there are a couple of approaches whether or not he wanted just to know that they were being honest with him. So they're bringing here a couple of different explanations as to why he would.
One thing that I heard a long time ago was it's almost sarcastic because Yehuda says. How can I bear to see what will happen to my father when I don't have the youngest son? And he says, well, I'm Yosef. Is he still alive?
Like he made it through the torment you put him through me. Yeah. You look here, the article brings up four or five different explanations for that phrase in verse 3. You could take a look there.
Okay.
That is, I think I believe he mentioned that. Okay. There are a bunch of explanations why he added that in the lesson. Okay, one last point that I want to add on this. So Yosef then continues, and he says to his brothers, he sees that they are entirely frightened, so he says to them in verse 4, come close to me. He speaks to them softly. I am your brother. It is me. And then he says in verse 5, and now be not distressed, nor reproach yourselves for having sold me here, for it was to be a provider that Hashem sent me ahead of you. This is what you had said earlier, that this is what has to have happened. It was divine in nature, and here is a tremendous lesson that Yosef teaches all of us. The brothers were an agent of distress for Yosef. They were an agent. He was sold. He was sold into captivity. He had to deal with all the trials and tribulations that he had to deal with. But Yosef sees clearly they were serving as an agent for a larger divine scheme and picture. And he himself is able to say to them, I don't have any complaints on you. I'm not holding you to be blamed for this. This was part of the divine scheme. I need to be in this position here in order to provide for our family. In the larger big picture, we then have the whole descent into Egypt in 210 years, eventually forming ourselves into a nation. This had to happen. And you were just the agents in which it happened, and therefore I'm telling you not to be angry at each other. I'm certainly not angry at you. I have been sent by Hashem, he says. He says it two or three different times over the next couple verses over the fact that this has taken place. And so often we have things that happen to us in life. Now, if it's done purposely by somebody else, then it's a different story. We each have our own level of free will, and we can affect certain things. We can discuss that also, but certainly in situations in which it's even less than that. A person gets into, say, a car accident, and they're fine, but they're financially it's going to cost them a whole lot of money. The person that it happened to wasn't necessarily at fault, doing it on purpose, maybe negative, whatever it was. There's a divine outlook on that that says, this is what has to. I now have to go through the grief, financially and emotionally, and all the time dealing with this. You are an agent that it happened with. If my anger is directed at you for being distracted by whatever you were distracted by, you were on your cell phone, you missed a stop sign, I'm missing the point. Point is that something was directed at me which needed to happen, and in the divine scheme of things, you were chosen as an agent under this circumstance to be the one to bring it about. But it's an internal thing that needs to be addressed. You were just a messenger through which this needed to happen, this needed to be brought about, and when we put the blame on the agent who is bringing about whatever it is that's happening, we very often are sidestepping the real issue. the reason why these things need to be brought about, and the divine scheme of that, and just putting the blame on the doorstep of somebody who did something wrong to us. Yosef is very clear here several times, pointing out to the brothers not to be angry, not to be sad, and to understand in verse 8, in the way that he says that it was not you who sent me here, but God. It wasn't you. You think you sent me here. In the physical manifestation, you sent me here. It wasn't you who sent me here. Hashem sent me here. So often we have to be able to see. The more that we see and open up our eyes, as we learned last week also, if you're looking for spirituality, if you're looking to grow, you will. But if you're not looking for it, then you're never going to find anything. That's what we saw, right? Yosef, he was looking for his brothers. He recognized them. The brothers weren't looking for him. They didn't recognize him. So if you're looking for the divine hand in things, you will see that it is not you who sent me here, Yossi says to his brother. It was Hashem who sent me here for whatever purposes that has. All right, but those are some of the nice ideas that come out of this week's parasha. So we had first the Ramban discussing the miracle of Yocheved's birth. Very Hanukkah-related idea that all those types of miraculous events aren't listed. They're all miracles. Everything in the Torah is miracles. And if it happens in a natural course of events, a woman has a baby. All right, very nice. She didn't start flying through the air. She said, that's what happens. Those things don't need to be listed. All things in the Torah are miraculous. Therefore, it's only hinted at but not explicitly mentioned as we celebrate 8 days of Hanukkah. For the same reason, we have then the ideas of Yosef and his revelation to his brothers, Ani Yosef, the clarity that's brought about through that, the lesson to us as to what will be on the Day of Judgment when the clarity, we also achieve that level of clarity and see what we could have been and could have done, given that, and the level of speechlessness that we will have. All right, have a wonderful day and a good rest of the week.